Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Agnostics, long-haired weirdos, short-haired weirdos, vandals, hooligans.
The government, hug the government, love the government, hug the government, love the government.
Welcome to The Politics Gods, a place for bipartisan, rational, and civil debate on American politics and policy. I'm Michael Baranowski, professor of political science at Northern Kentucky University. I'm joined today by my conservative counterpart, Cleveland area attorney and defender of freedom, Jay Carson.
Hey, good afternoon, Mike.
Hey, Jay. Happy Friday the 13th to you.
Yeah, it's Friday afternoon, Mike, and I'm cooking with gas.
Well, we won't be getting to that in the regular show, but we definitely will be talking about all the Republicans who are cooking with gas on our midweek show. And we have a lot to get to, certainly, on our regular show. We're going to be talking about, well, of course, Biden's classified documents and storage and House weaponization, the House weaponization of the federal government committee. I think I got that right. And the various
name.
Yeah, I thought you might like it, actually. The House rules package and particularly Speaker McCarthy's move or proposed move to kick some Democrats off of committees. The big air traffic control outage on Wednesday of this week and maybe some other things if we have time. So, as always, we have plenty to get to. And we will get started in just 1 second.
Hey, down in Joe's Garage, we didn't have no dope or LSD, but a couple of quarts of beer.
Well, there might not have been any dope or LSD in Joe's Garage, but there were some classified documents. And Jay, thank you for suggesting that Frank Zappa musical intro to our top story this week. This week, Attorney General Merrick Garland announced the appointment of a special counsel to investigate, in Garland's words, the possible unauthorized removal and retention of classified documents or other records discovered at the Penn Center for Diplomacy and Global Engagement and the Wilmington, Delaware private residence of President Joseph R. Biden, Jr. The special counsel, Robert Hur, is in the mold of almost every special counsel, I'd say, a Republican attorney with a lot of investigatory, a lot of prosecutorial experience, and a pretty sterling reputation as a nonpartisan, straight-shooting sort of guy. He was appointed U.S. attorney for the District of Maryland from 2018 to 2021. Before that, he was a special assistant to current FBI Director Christopher Wray, who at the time was running the criminal division of the Department of Justice. He's a Stanford Law graduate, Harvard before that, and he also clerked for Judge Alex Kaczynski of the Ninth Circuit, as well as Chief Justice William Rehnquist. So that's, as resumes go, it doesn't get a whole lot better. I think you would agree.
He sounds okay.
Yeah, probably going to be adequate.
He sounds like he knows what he's doing.
Probably. Now, here's what we currently know about the documents. The first batch of them was uncovered in early November at the Penn Center, which is a Washington, D.C. think tank affiliated with, as the name would suggest, the University of Pennsylvania and founded by Biden. And he'd used some office space there after his time as vice president ended in 2017. Now, the office was not a location authorized for classified document storage, which is a problem, of course. On discovering the documents, Biden's attorneys turned them over to the National Archives, at which point the Inspector General of the National Archives contacted the Justice Department to let them know that the White House had disclosed finding classified documents there. Following that, the FBI got involved, and by mid-November, Attorney General Garland had assigned U.S. Attorney John Lausch to conduct an initial investigation. Then more classified documents were found in the course of that investigation, which led Lausch on January 5th to recommend to Garland that a special counsel be appointed. The story broke on January 9th with the White House saying they were cooperating fully with the investigation. And Garland, as I mentioned, announced that special counsel. So, Jay, what's your reaction to this one?
I guess, my first reaction, and I'll, we can talk about this later. But there was the sense that when we elected Joe Biden, people sort of elected him to, one, not be Bernie Sanders, and two, not be Donald Trump. And it's almost like he's being able to almost accomplish both, right? There's sort of this sense of when, you know, confidential documents are discovered at the pool table in Mar-a-Lago and Trump, a lot of people sort of say, yeah, that sounds like him. Yeah, that figures. But we were kind of hoping that wasn't, you know, that same sort of thing just wouldn't come up with President Biden, yet here we are. That's my initial, you know, kind of quick take. The second piece is, barring anything else that I'm going to learn, right? My sense is this is probably inadvertent. I don't know. But that would be my presumption. Still, there are a whole lot of other people who can get themselves into a whole lot of trouble for inadvertently mishandling classified documents. And it was an interesting piece I read that it seems that the difference, I would say, is less in terms of party, but rather if you're a famous person or a non-famous person, in terms of, you know, how strenuously the rules are enforced against you. For Garland's part, I think he did the right thing appointing a special counsel, because I don't know what else he could have done given the situation where we find ourselves in. So, kudos to him for that. And it sounds like they picked a certainly competent special counsel. So we'll see how it plays out. But it certainly presents a not necessarily, if not a legal problem, in prosecuting Trump, certainly a political perception problem in doing so. So that's my very kind of quick take, sure. But we can get it more.
I agree with you on a few things, and maybe I'll make some distinctions on a few others. I agree, and I felt this way about the Trump case, that simply having some classified documents, now in the Trump case, it looks like there are considerably more of them, at least according to court filings. We're talking about 184 in 15 boxes. For Biden, we don't know, but it doesn't seem like it's more than a couple
less
of dozen. Considerably less. But still, all the same, I totally agree with you that if you are a nobody and you have a classified document, you are far more likely to be prosecuted than if you are a somebody. And if you're a president or former president, absolutely, there's a huge difference there. So I think you hit the nail on the head exactly there. I will point out, though, I think there is an important difference in how each of these individuals handled the case, right? In the Biden case, for everything that we know right now, and again, there is an investigation, I don't want to speculate, but it seems like they uncovered these things, they found them, and it was like, oh, wow, we should have turned these in. And the first thing they did was contact the National Archives. The process was followed. President Biden says they're fully and completely cooperating. We don't have any indications to the contrary about that. Compared to Donald Trump's bizarre claims and outright lies from some of his people, at least, about whether or not all these documents had been turned over and other things. And so when we're talking about criminal activity or potential criminal activity, it is, you know, there are statutes that prohibit misuse or misappropriation of classified documents. There are also, though, and this applies just to Trump, things about destroying official documents potentially, or failing to deliver national security documents on demand to officials that are authorized to take custody of them, and that sort of thing. So it's when you get into willful retention, which seems to be much more in line with the Trump case, and that's why I guess I'll make some distinction there between Trump and Biden on this, in that there seems to be an element of scope and scale and willful unwillingness, if you will, to comply with the instruction to return documents that we see in the Trump case that we don't see, at least to this point, in the Biden case.
Yeah, no, I think that's correct. But to a certain extent, depending on what statutes you're looking at, it doesn't matter.
Well, explain.
Right? I mean, I think here's the thing. Let's put it this way. If you're possessing the documents where you're not supposed to have them, That's a strict liability offense. Now you can say there's mitigating or aggravating conduct that goes with it, right? And I think there may be additional pieces that or additional things that Trump could be charged with that Biden would not be. But the fundamental problem is, if you got stuff you're not supposed to have, then you're not supposed to have it.
Yeah.
I mean, in many cases, you're not supposed to take it out of the office, period. And that's where the crime essentially occurs, if you will, is when you remove it. So I think there's that issue there. But the bigger thing, I think, in terms of not whether or not there's a, is it politically, is it possible to get to prosecute this? Sure. But those distinctions, I think, may well be lost on the public, because those are going to be some kind of fine lines to draw.
Well, yes and no. It depends on
between prosecuting a former president and not prosecuting the current president.
Well, actually, no.
The former president might run against him.
I mean, as Bob Mueller would tell you, the DOJ has a policy, longstanding, of not indicting sitting presidents. And so I would assume that still stands if you wanted to indict a sitting president on this. And I would have been.
I would second that. I think that's absolutely correct. Yeah.
And actually, in the Trump case, and I don't think that I'm changing my position here. I think in the Trump case, even if there had been, 200, 300 classified documents, and the Trump people, after they moved back to Mar-a-Lago, said, "Oh, we found these things. Here you go. We're returning them." To me, I would have just said, "Well, okay. Transitions are messy, and transitions are especially messy when they're going from one party to another." And I'm honestly willing to give people a lot of,
And even messier when they're going from Donald Trump to someone else.
And so, I mean, I'm willing to cut presidents and former presidents some slack on that. And so to me, it's like the difference between, hey, you walk out of the store and you forgot you had a pack of gum in your pocket, what have you. Okay, I'll come back and pay for it. You walk out of the store and then the security guard say you didn't pay for that. You say, well, screw you. I'm not going to pay for it. It's mine. I paid for
declassified.
It. Exactly. Yes. So that's a whole different kind of thing. And so that's where I think, that is not just a distinction, but it's a distinction that makes a real difference.
I don't know that it makes a difference in the actual elements of the crime, though.
Well, in the elements, right? it does make a difference in terms of what crimes the individual can be charged with. But in terms of the mishandling classified documents, no, it's the same underlying crime. But when you get into willfully withholding and destroying, then you can get into weird things like Espionage Act, depending on what the classified documents are and all that. And by the way, in neither case do we know the nature of these classified documents, and that can make a difference, certainly.
Sure.
I would think.
My other thought, though, is, on the politics of this, though, wouldn't you agree this makes a prosecution of Trump much more difficult?
Well, I say
politically,
I wouldn't say legally, it makes it more difficult. I would say it imposes more of a political cost, because now, like you said, people who don't understand the nuances of this and the details would say, hey, Trump did it and Biden does it and apparently everyone does it. But of course, they're going after Trump because he's Trump, not understanding these what I would argue to be pretty important differences. So, yeah, I agree with you on that. But in the end, I don't think anything's going to legally. I don't think President Biden is assuming nothing else comes out. I don't really see that there's going to be much here aside from, again, that sort of perception argument for a lot of folks who don't really know the details of these cases, which is most people.
Right. And I could argue, I think there's. And again, we don't know enough details necessarily to argue the differences between one or the other.
Well, I would disagree, because I think we know some important details about the willingness or unwillingness of the parties involved to cooperate. We know at least something initially about who approached whom with the documents, who asked for the documents, or in the Biden's case, they actually volunteered them. So I think we do know enough to say that there are some already clear distinctions, but there could be more things that come out in the course of, both of these investigations, in fact.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, riddle me this here. So what happens if you have a a prosecution of Trump, followed by the election of Trump. And then where does Joe Biden sit at that point, having being a former and thus indictable president?
Well, I mean, it seems to
that's my concern as we start to veer into banana republic territory.
I agree, because this is the sort of thing that I think if even a decade ago, one would suggest you'd even consider indicting a president for having a few classified
documents. You would say sort of a no harm, no foul.
Exactly.
Everybody walk away.
But yeah, that's not,
which I still think is the correct approach.
I agree. Absolutely. You want to give people a little bit of slack, but clearly this is a give no quarter type of environment, unfortunately. And I see this as the beginning of kind of a new normal for this sort of thing, which is a scary thought.
Well, I don't know if it's the beginning, right? Because I think this has been I've complained to you about this. You've done nothing about it for years now, about the criminalization of politics. That I think that's a tremendous problem, and that's been going on, I don't know, probably at least a good 20, 30 years. And I understand there's difficulties sometimes in drawing lines between what to do when politicians do commit criminal offenses, and some of them do. But there's a lot of I'm thinking, for example, the prosecution of the Ted Murkowski, which struck me as over. And again, I think the Justice Department is sometimes put in a place where, look, there's undoubtable criminal activity and you've got to prosecute it. But there's also times where there are ticky-tack, campaign finance violation type. I'm thinking also some of the Trump cronies, the foreign agent registration penalties, that sort of thing, which again are in regulatory, right? They are they're malum prohibitum, not malum in se.
But in some instances, of course, you have those prosecutions as a way to use leverage on those folks to get them to provide information about larger criminal offenses or potential criminal offenses.
Sure.
And that's why they can be important. And all I'm saying, I'm not disagreeing with you, but I'm saying that it's important to look at these things in the larger context, because usually criminal enterprises have lesser and greater crimes than criminals. And ideally you want to use the little fish to get to the bigger fish.
Right.
And
in this case, we've got the two biggest fish
we can have
starting
whales.
Out. But I would be remiss if I didn't mention the reports that it was Joe Biden who suggested I'm blanking on the act.
Which one?
Logan Act.
Okay,
Logan Act,
sure.
Prosecution against Michael Flynn.
Right.
Which kicked off a whole lot of this trouble. And it's that kind of thing of the not the look, what can we do that's embarrassing? You know, what can we pull out that's embarrassing and will hurt this person politically, cost them leverage, cost them votes, versus can we do to lock them up?
Yeah.
And that was Trump said, lock her up. Yeah,
absolutely. So this kind of segues very nicely, I think, into our next story we wanted to talk about. And that's that. You know, this week, House Republicans, I think they really sort of formally kicked off what we all expect to be a flurry of investigations. That's a flurry, right? Flock of geese.
They come in flurries.
They come in flurries. Okay. And they did that in part by approving the formation of a select subcommittee on the weaponization of the federal government, to be chaired by Representative Jim Jordan, a former guest on this show, I should point out.
I know him.
Yeah, absolutely. So there we go. A connection to that, for better or worse. But anyway, the committee will have 13 members. They'll be appointed by Speaker McCarthy, with not more than 5 appointed in consultation with Minority Leader Jeffries. So that's about as bipartisan as it's going to get. I mean, technically, you look at margins in the House, it should probably be 7-6, but that's, reasonably bipartisan. Anyway, the resolution on this instructs the committee to issue a final report no later than January 2nd of 2025 regarding primarily the expansive role of Article II authority vested in the executive branch to collect information on or otherwise investigate citizens of the United States, including ongoing criminal investigations, and also includes any unconstitutional, illegal, or unethical activities committed against citizens of the United States. Now, in his floor speech that followed the vote on this, Jordan said, "This is about the First Amendment, something you guys," referring to the Democrats, "used to care about." Jordan claimed that the executive branch has been employing a double standard, trying to silence conservatives. He said, "We don't want to go after anyone. We just want it to stop, and we want to respect the First Amendment to the Constitution that the greatest country in the world has." Now, a number of House Republicans are really making comparisons between this committee and the Church Committee of the 1970s. That was a huge.
I was just going to say the Church Committee.
You're wrong about that. We'll talk about why. But anyway, I get why it's a talking point. And the Church Committee was really important. It uncovered decades of abuses by the FBI, CIA. There was a time when senators, when presidents would quake in their boots about what the FBI had on them. There's a story about Gary Hart was one of the, I think he's the only living member of the Church Committee, because it was back in 1975. And he was asked, by Frank Church, who chaired it, said, "Well, you know, what do you think, how do you think we should start off?" And Hart said, "You know, I think it'd be really good if we asked the FBI to give us the files that they have on us." And there was just silence in the room. And one of the senior members said, "I don't know that I want to see their file on me." So, I mean, this was the way, because you got to remember, Hoover ran the FBI as his own personal fiefdom for like nearly half a century. There was some seriously bad stuff going on. There's no question about it. Now, Democrats, on the other hand, are suggesting more that it's along the lines of the House Un-American Activities Committee, which, of course, now is widely seen not as a wonderful success of democracy and reform, but as a Trump word would be a witch hunt, right? So, Jay, I would expect that the truth isn't either of those extremes, but how do you see this weaponization committee?
Well, first of all, I don't like the name. They could have come up with a much better name. But that notwithstanding, right? I mean, again, whether it's even just the Jordan Committee, right? Like they call it the Church Committee, or I suppose that may be what it will be known to as history as later decades. But I think it's vitally important that this committee does its work. And you mentioned the Church Committee uncovered a whole lot of bad stuff that the FBI and the CIA were doing that. One, people didn't know they were doing before you had a Church Committee investigate. So I think there's something to be said there that just because, you know, we haven't found everything and the committee hasn't met yet doesn't mean that there isn't some skullduggery going on. In fact, I think there's a lot of smoke that would indicate fire.
Agreed.
You know, I mean, the FBI doesn't keep files on people anymore. I mean, I expect there are cabinets with the label Donald J. Trump on them.
I totally agree with you. One of my concerns, and this points out why I have some issues with the Church Committee comparison. The Church Committee, the vote to form that in the Senate was 82-4. It was a 6-5 committee. The final report was approved by every single one of the committee members. Frank Church wrote that the members work together in remarkable harmony. I mean, this is not what we're setting up here. And so my concern is that it's not just the word weaponization. This is a committee, it seems to me, that has already decided on where it's looking and what it's looking for. And if this were just the House exercising its oversight, which I think it should, especially about law enforcement, and they were just saying, "We're just going to go where the evidence takes us, and hey, you know, we're concerned with protecting every American's civil liberties," I would be all for it. But all of the references I've heard from Jordan, or many of the references, have been about conservatives. And this seems to me to be a committee out to prove that the federal government is anti-conservative. And that, to me, if you start with the conclusion you're already going to end with, that's a problem.
So I agree with the statement. I don't necessarily agree with its applicability to the committee. But going back to Jordan's initial remarks, right, saying the Democrats, it says something some of you used to believe in. Granted, I think that's some hyperbole, and it's sort of, you know, the Jordan floor speech, raw meat type thing. But that said, I don't think you can disagree that there used to be a lot more civil libertarians among Democratic ranks than there are now. That there was less of the sense of circle the wagons around the FBI or the CIA or the NSA or these agencies. And in fact, you know, a lot of the victims of the crimes that were uncovered by the Church Committee were liberals, right? It was abuses of conservative administrations and law enforcement and intelligence against liberal activists in many cases, not in all cases, but many. And I think, you know, that there were a whole lot of Republicans who back then said, yes, this is wrong. And I think they're still there. I wonder, I mean, you don't see as many Democrats. Again, there, you seems know, to be this distinctive protection of anything FBI, anything government.
Well, I think that there certainly is that partisan impulse, no question. But I think that if I'm being asked to believe the sort of more theoretical and reasonable claims you make, number one, it wouldn't be called the Weaponization Committee. Number two, Jim Jordan, an election denier, would not be the chair of it. And so now some of this might depend on who McCarthy appoints to this committee. But my sense is that all of the arguments that Democrats had about Adam Schiff and his stuff about Trump and Russia are going to be equally applicable, if not more so, to this. And so it's, you know, to me, the idea that this is anything but an attempt to make a partisan advantage out of what could be, I think, if it were handled correctly, and I think there may be some other House oversight activities that are going to be handled much more responsibly, we'll get to that in a minute, could be something that would be very valuable. But there doesn't seem to be the interest in that. It's all about owning the libs.
It can always be both. I mean, you can have the committee that's for a partisan advantage, but also for a good particular
can it
overall
though, I mean health. I made the case.
That's part of how the system works, right?
I think, Jay, that you're living in a time warp, and it's kind of touching and quaint in a way that there's a part of you that really still thinks that Congress and the Republican Party and the partisanship operates like it did in the 1990s, and that sort of pre Gingrich sort of world is gone. And you just need to accept that, I think.
I mean, I think back, but I mean, do you think, for example, the Watergate committee in the 70s, you know, when they put that together, they said, look, guys, we're not doing this for any kind of partisan advantage. We just want to get the facts. No, of course.
Well, of course.
Democrats were doing it for a partisan advantage, and they obtained a partisan advantage and they got the facts. And I think, you know, did a service to the country in the process. And again, that's, you know, if you have a good thing.
But the reason they could do that service is because there was enough Republican support of what they were doing, as opposed to, you know, like 10 congressional Democrats, most of whom weren't able to win or didn't even bother to run for reelection. And so that's, I mean, the amount of partisanship today as compared to the 1970s makes it, I would argue, almost impossible to conduct very fair investigations that aren't predominantly political. And then when each party says, well, you know, they started it, so we're just going to crank it up to the next level, I mean, that, where does that sort of logic end? It ends in a bad place.
Well, I guess my question, sort of just turning it on its head, is that, well, why can't Democrats support, again, setting aside the name, which I think is dumb, and they could have done much better with that, and it would have been a much better committee, much better selling point down the road. But why can't Democrats get on board and say, yeah, you know, if there are abuses from the FBI and intelligence agencies, we want them stopped, even if those abuses happen to have been against conservatives.
Even if those abuses
happen to have been against Donald Trump.
And I'm a Democrat who says that, and I believe there are congressional Democrats who believe that. And that's why I'm withholding. A lot depends on the members who are chosen for this. You can envision membership of this committee that will make it nothing but a dog and pony show, nothing but a screaming, awful sham on both sides. But you can also envision a composition of this committee that might make it less likely to be that way. Though, again, with Jim Jordan heading it, one of the most, I would argue, sort of polarizing figures in Congress, that's going to make it tough right from the get-go. And I think that's a signal right away.
So I think the other thing is going to be, though, what evidence is adduced and brought forward.
Sure, absolutely.
By this committee.
Yeah.
It's going to make a difference.
Yeah. Definitely.
Right? I mean, they may come up with, smoking gun type violations.
Yeah, and
they
I want to see that. Absolutely. But I hope
they may come up with nothing. And that's, and I think that's sort of the difference, right? If it is sort of, again, the ticky tack type stuff, and it's, again, the committee tries to blow it up into this is a constitutional crisis, then I think it flops. But if there is, so-called type smoking gun material, I think there's
I'm sure there'll be some. Yeah, I'm sure there'll be some. Yeah. My concern is that you're going to have the five Democrats saying, okay, we would like to subpoena these folks because there are potentially some issues with that don't just involve silencing conservatives and the response of Jordan.
Well, absolutely.
And
subpoena, bring them in.
And
that's why
if you were chairing this committee, I'd be all for it. But, you know, you're unfortunately, I can't get you to run for Congress. So, I don't know what to do, Jay. You're not as nearly as much help to me here as you would be in Congress.
I'll put in a good word to Jim and pass along our suggestions.
Maybe that'll help. But, I mentioned that I thought that there were and there could be in this 118th Congress House investigation committees that might have a chance of being, in my view, a little better run and organized and chaired. I wanted to mention one because this investigation is entirely separate from the House Oversight Committee's investigation. They're calling it the Biden family investigation, which, right, according to the Biden...
That's also a sort of a silly name.
I kind of like that one a little better. I don't know. But they have a Biden family investigation website already set up, so that's handy. But it's focusing on the Biden family's domestic and international business dealings, and they're going to try to determine whether these dealings have compromised U.S. national security and Biden's ability to lead with impartiality. And that, to me, is like, that sounds like a reasonable thing to investigate. But there's also, I think, a clear assumption built into the investigation even before it begins, because there's on the summary page, they assert members of the Biden family have a pattern of peddling access to the highest levels of government to enrich themselves, often to the detriment of U.S. interests. Now,
those damn Bidens.
But what I'm saying is that they're...
Right. That's rather conclusory for the before the committee's met.
And even if you say, well, that seems pretty reasonable to say on behalf of a particular Biden, Hunter Biden, who's going to get more media than he ever wanted, but arguing that it's members, plural, of the Biden family, and that is a pattern, and that it is often to the detriment of U.S. interests, that sounds exactly like they're assuming facts not yet in evidence, I guess, is my concern.
So
that's my negatives on that. But I will say, I think I'm okay with the person.
But who other than you goes and checks out the web pages?
I don't know. But anyway, the guy sharing it, Jim Comer, he's a Kentucky Republican. He's in his fourth term. I like what he said, at least, on this. He said earlier this summer, in fact, he had an interview with Politico. He said, I'm not going to be chasing some of these right-wing blogs and some of their conspiracy theories. This isn't a dog and pony show. This isn't a committee where everyone's going to scream and be outraged and try to make witnesses look like fools. Unlike Adam Schiff, we're going to have something concrete, substantive on Hunter Biden, or I'm not going to talk about Hunter Biden. And, Comer, he's not a moderate, but he's not a Freedom Caucus guy. And he was in the minority of House Republicans who voted to affirm the certification of the state's Electoral College vote. So, like, if you're going to have oversight of the executive branch or an investigation of Biden, and I think in this case with the Hunter Biden stuff, hey, that seems reasonable to me. This is the sort of guy I think is reasonable to lead that kind of investigation. And I'm keeping an open mind on this one. What's your?
I agree. I agree. No, and I think that's a good good thing to investigate.
I mean, why not?
Again, I'd rather it's not called the Biden family. I mean, sort of that seems sort of narrow. I think maybe you ought to look at, you could call it other stuff about influence peddling, throughout, without just making it look so directed as hey, we're going after this one guy and his family, because I think that's the kind of thing we want to get away from. But obviously Hunter Biden plays bigly in that. So,
one other thing I wanted to get your take on is, this actually goes back to that weaponization committee, is one of the things they said they're going to be looking at, or potentially looking at, is ongoing investigations. And to me, and I would think to a lot of folks, that's kind of a red flag, because what does that potentially do to the integrity of ongoing investigations? There's a longstanding practice, not just with DOJ, but I think with prosecutors everywhere on every level, to not release details of ongoing investigations. I think in many cases for some very, very good reasons, to protect the safety and reputations of the people involved. And I think there are legitimate concerns that once you have this committee doing that, that there might be some very real threats to those things. And I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
I think that's right. But it depends on what we're talking about in terms of ongoing investigations, right? I mean, you're talking ongoing criminal investigations by, say, the FBI. I would think there could be a problem in terms of, if you're investigating, is the FBI conducting an investigation fairly, or is this a political vendetta? Or if you're trying to get information to say the FBI is maybe soft pedaling other stuff. And you ask the FBI, hey, we'd like information on all these topics. If they are allowed to simply have the response of, hey, that's an ongoing investigation, sorry, we can't talk to you, that would seem to defeat the committee's purposes. So I would agree in principle, right, that you can't, you shouldn't interfere with that. But I think the committee should be cautious when they get that response, that excuse, and to see, listen, is it really something related to the ongoing investigation, or can you just keep the investigation ongoing so that you don't have to answer the committee?
Yeah, I mean, there is a line between, I think, appropriate oversight and keeping the executive branch agencies, which, are created and funded by Congress, on their toes and staying within the law. I think it's critically important. But you can also see that going over into essentially intimidation. And that's where it becomes a concern. And I'm doing my best. I will do my best to keep an open mind until we actually have, some sort of deliverables from these committees, right? Some sort of actual information. But like I said, especially in the case of the weaponization thing, just the fact, knowing Jim Jordan's recent past and statements, it's going to be hard for me to see this turning out in a good way, in a fair way. But I hope I'm wrong about that, because if there are, I agree with you. There are, I don't think you could really take a deep dive, a serious look at any large law enforcement investigatory organization and not find something. Right. I mean, I think that just, it would be surprising to me if you found nothing. I'd be concerned about any investigation that said, no, the FBI, the CIA, the DOJ, they're all clean as a whistle. No problem.
Do a good job.
Yeah,
yep.
Exactly. That would raise a red flag for me. So I just hope that there will be enough Democrats who are pushing for fairness on that, and enough Republicans who agree that this should be at least an attempt at fairness, and we get some, positive results out of it. That would be great.
All right. I'll do my part to try to keep it fair.
All right. We're going to take just a quick break, and we'll be back to talk about, well, more congressional stuff, and also that big FAA airline outage and what that might mean. All right, Jay. So, last week, we talked about all those concessions that Kevin McCarthy had to make to his sort of right flank in order to get the votes he needed to be elected speaker. And many of those concessions came in the form of his agreeing to change the internal rules of the chamber. And of course, that's not something he can do unilaterally. requiring, you know, that it requires a majority of the chamber to approve. And early this week, that approval did come. And essentially everything we talked about last week was what happened. Though what we, I would say that our general position on that last week was that we didn't really see these deals as being particularly outrageous or that they unreasonably empowered the right wing of the party, though I'd say the Freedom Caucus.
I had more issues than you did.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like they used their leverage in an understandable way. I mean, there's something like a quarter of the Democratic caucus. And I'm like, well, okay, they could use their numbers. And sure, now they're punching a little bit even more above their weight. But honestly, I don't see it as being that big of a deal. But I didn't want to. So, yeah, what's your take now? You've had another week to kind of think about it as well. We've seen the details.
I'm pretty much where I was last week, right? That I think some of those are good, helpful, needed reforms. Others are just kind of recipes for gumming up the works. So I think giving more independence to committee chairs, I think that's great. Flash vote for a speaker is a terrible idea.
The flash vote for a speaker thing that was in place until Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats took over Congress. That's how it always had been. And so is this Jay Carson coming out against tradition?
No, I'm also happy to, after experience, yield to, learn from experience. Times were different then. And my concern is, again, that could be used to gum up the works, at inopportune times.
So is this,
and it's sad because in some ways it diminishes the power of the caucus and the majority party.
But does it really? I don't think we're going to see many. Now, this is under the rules, this is a privileged motion, which means that it takes precedence and anyone can call for it. And basically everything stops to have a vote on this. But I don't think it's going to happen. I just don't see it as being, if you have the votes to remove the speaker and you want to, it doesn't matter if it's one or five or a majority that needs to call for it as it was in the Democratic House under Speaker Pelosi. So That's the thing.
You don't call for it to actually remove the speaker. You call for it to gum up the works.
I don't think it's well
because it takes precedent over everything else.
We'll see. But my prediction is that we'll come back in 6 months or a year, and even sooner, and I'll say, well, what happened to all those votes to oust the speaker? And you'll say, well, Mike, you were right again. There really weren't any votes to oust the speaker. Maybe okay. There were a couple, but right. They didn't gum up the works.
We will make that a wager.
Okay, yeah. Sounds good. So, you know, one thing we didn't, though, talk about last week was Kevin McCarthy's longstanding pledge to remove a number of Democrats from committees. Specifically, I want to first focus on removing Adam Schiff and Eric Swalwell from the House Intelligence Committee. Now, you might recall that Schiff and Swalwell, there were two of the leaders of the Donald Trump impeachments. Schiff was the lead manager of the first one. Swalwell was one of the nine impeachment managers for the second one. And a lot of Democrats see this move by McCarthy as retribution for that, as well as for Democrats stripping two Republicans, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Paul Gosar, of their committee assignments in the last Congress. And McCarthy, like I said, for months, he's clearly stated his intention to remove them from the Intelligence Committee. He's saying it's for other reasons. In Schiff's case, McCarthy argues it's about Schiff lying to the public about ties between Donald Trump and Russia. In McCarthy's words, he put America for 4 years through an impeachment that he knew was a lie. Now, in the case of Swalwell, McCarthy is citing these ties, alleged ties to a suspected Chinese spy who was a fundraiser for Swalwell's 2014 reelection campaign. McCarthy said, if you got the briefing I got from the FBI, you wouldn't have Swalwell on any committee. Now, he wasn't charged with any wrongdoing in this, and he cut ties with this Chinese national when he was informed of the spy allegations. And a lot of people on the left see this as just a big phony pretext on the right. And then finally, I should mention, McCarthy has said he plans to remove Ilhan Omar from her Foreign Affairs Committee post due to her history of anti-Semitic comments. So those are the three Democrats he almost certainly will be removing when committee assignments are made. Jay, what do you take? And I think we should maybe look at that the Intelligence Committee thing separately, because I think it is kind of a separate issue. But what's your take on that?
Yeah, I think that's the right call on all three.
Okay, well, let's start with those two.
So starting with Schiff, the presence on the Intelligence Committee gives members ability to have information that other members and the public at large don't. And with that, I think should come a responsibility to use your position on the Intelligence Committee responsibly. And I don't think that's what Schiff did. Schiff made lots and lots of statements under the guise of, hey, look, I'm chair of the Intelligence Committee. I know what's going on. And let me tell you, oh boy. And that turned out to be false. And I think that was an abuse of his power. It hurt the committee. It hurt a lot of folks. So I'm all for that. In the case of Swalwell, I think maybe you're undersumming a little bit. As I understand, the evidence is he was actually sleeping with someone who was a Chinese spy for some time. Now you can say, well, they broke up, and as soon as he found out about it, he ended it. But not sleeping with a Chinese spy for someone on the Intelligence Committee, I think, would be something you'd look for, right? I would think anyone who is on that committee ought to be, all of their relationships ought to be analyzed, especially if they have any kind of close relationships with foreign nationals, especially if they have close relationships with Chinese foreign nationals. So to me, that's an absolute no-brainer. I would say even if you've got someone who is completely legitimate ties with someone who happens to be a foreign national, that should come under a great deal of scrutiny before you put them on that committee and allow them access to the information that they have access to.
Now, I guess there are two questions I have, and those I think in general aren't unreasonable points, but I guess I have concerns with number one, who gets to make that determination?
The Speaker.
And number two, do you have any concerns that that determination might be made with partisan advantage in mind?
Well, it can be both. Again, you can get rid of someone who is an absolute weasel, and it can serve your partisan advantage. And when it does both, well, that's kind of an indication that the system's working. Right?
So you think McCarthy is would veto any Republican members who wanted to be on or stay on the Intelligence Committee, even if they funnel documents to Trump's folks? And I seem to recall, and I can't recall.
I would hope so. Yeah,
I can't recall. But I think, again, this is where you're living in the past, Jay. That's not how it works. And I'm blanking on the member's name, but there was a high ranking House Republican who had clearly given documents to Donald Trump. And I forget that he wasn't supposed to have, and I forget who he was. But my point being is that I don't disagree with your points in general. If it is the case, and I don't agree with this to the extent that maybe you do, that Adam Schiff knowingly lied about Donald Trump's ties to Russia, as opposed to engaged in hyperbole, like apparently is okay for Jim Jordan
to do.
Let's
even back off the knowingly. Let's just say recklessly made statements with reckless disregard of their truth.
If we're going to disqualify members of the House Intelligence Committee for reckless statements, I don't know if we're going to be able to get a quorum.
Well, maybe so.
That's my problem. It becomes a political retribution tool. And that's, I think that's not okay.
You know, I guess it's at some point, the system runs on political retribution. Right?
It seems that way.
I'm just saying, if you are, I've been in the minority, I've been in the majority, and no, majority's better.
But I find
because
it
because look, there's that happens in every time there's a change in leadership, whether it's in a state house, whether it's in Congress, whether it's on a board of directors, whether it's wherever, right? You take out their guys and you put in your guys. Or if there are people who are egregious, you take out those egregious guys and let the other people put in someone in who's less egregious.
I think
it's fine if you want to say, hey, Democrats, you have this other seat here or these two seats on intelligence, and you can fill them with whoever you want, except for Schiff and Swalwell for the reasons we stated.
And I should point out that it's important to make a distinction between removing someone from a specific committee for, I would say, clear, ideally proven information that links them to something that could create a conflict or make them inappropriate for that committee, especially when it's intelligence, and doing something like stripping someone of all of their committee assignments, which is designed to be a punitive measure, which is what...
Right, which is what they did to Marjorie Taylor Greene, just because she's nuts.
Well, because she's nuts and she threatened violence against members of Congress and elected officials. Yeah. And, you know, so
that goes with the being nuts.
Well, yeah. There are plenty of nuts who don't necessarily like Gosar, you know, films videos of him chopping AOC's head off. You know, that's it was an anime thing. But still, the point being is that, yeah, I think that is a different sort of a thing than this is much more strategic, I guess you could say. And in a way, I wouldn't say it's more justifiable because it's different offenses, right? This is not designed, at least ostensibly, not designed to be retribution. It's designed, if you take McCarthy at face value, to be simply not allowing people on committees who are unsuited to be on that committee.
Yeah.
And I guess
I would agree. And again, it goes back to it's the speaker's prerogative. Right.
Yeah. In the end, it is. You're right. It's the speaker's prerogative. And so I'm not saying, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying that he doesn't have the authority or that this is somehow unconstitutional or what have you. I'm just saying that, you know, there is a reason why for a long, long time there has been a tradition of allowing the minority party to basically staff the minority side of committees as they see fit.
Yeah,
and I think
in most cases that's appropriate and correct.
Right. And do you?
I would let's put it this: if I was Hakeem Jeffries, I would be happy to staff those committees with two people, at least intelligence, with two people other than or all three, right? The people we mentioned.
I don't know. I mean, certainly there are plenty of qualified.
To me, it's sort of just because their presence there creates more headaches than it helps.
Maybe so. I at least in the longer term, that's not necessarily an argument I would disagree with. But I think there's a distinction here between those two, which I wanted to look at them separately, and Omar, because now in both of those cases, you can say, hey, someone who's on the Intelligence Committee, let's assume that all those things that McCarthy is saying about Schiff and about Swalwell are accurate. Right? Well, yes, you're right. We don't want somebody, even if somebody was inadvertently sleeping
with a Chinese spy,
and they didn't know that person was a spy, still better to err on the side of caution. Fair enough,
right?
I think. More of a gray area, but fair enough. And certainly, if someone is knowingly telling lies about information that they received in the Intelligence Committee briefings to the general public, yes, that person should not be on the Intelligence Committee. But it's a very different thing when you say, you know what, someone should not be on the Foreign Affairs Committee because they're saying things we don't like about foreign affairs and how things are in Israel and the power or alleged power of the Israel lobby in the United States. That's a very different thing. That's viewpoint discrimination as opposed to disqualifying someone for being unsuited. And I think those are two very different things.
Well, they are two very different things. But I also think it's the speaker's prerogative.
Oh, yeah. Again, I'm not arguing that he can't do it.
And it's also just smart not to have Ilhan Omar on the Foreign Relations Committee.
And you don't see this as just punishing a member of the squad.
No, I don't. Okay. I mean, because she said a lot of things that, it's not even construed as anti-Semitic. I think pretty much over the line. And I think if a Republican member did it, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, you ought to be removed from your committee assignment, especially one that deals with a sensitive ally in a sensitive region. Absolutely. I think that's appropriate. I mean, here's the thing. There's how many Democratic members of Congress? 218.
200.
Find somebody else.
Yeah. I remember, you know, Jay, I remember when you guys used to care about the First Amendment.
She can say whatever she wants about Israel and Palestine and make anti-Semitic cracks and all that kind of stuff. But that doesn't mean it's a good idea to have her on the Foreign Relations Committee doing so.
But see, that's what I'm saying. It changes what we're talking about. At one point, when we're talking about the Intelligence Committee,
one is sort of a conduct criminal type discrimination. Another is a viewpoint discrimination.
Yeah.
And I say, viewpoint discrimination. Let's put it this way. The January 6th committee, that was staffed with a whole lot of viewpoint discrimination in terms of they didn't want anyone who had the viewpoint that, this wasn't a crime, wasn't a riot, it wasn't a coup attempt.
I would disagree with that. I think that's a qualifications thing because some of the people who wanted to be on the committee flat out were arguing, were saying false things that had been demonstrably false. And so I think that's a whole different thing. But I think that just confuses the issue because in this instance, again, it becomes, you often ask me about what the limiting principle is. And here, I think that's a very good question and there's not a good answer. So, okay, she said some things that were clearly over the line. And for all of those things that were clearly over the line that I am aware of, she has issued some sort of combination of a retraction or apology, and maybe it didn't seem sincere, what have you. There are some things that I would not call anti-Semitic, but were certainly harshly critical of Israel, which I think are, and again, you want to make sure that the Foreign Affairs Committee is not just the sort of, Israel lobby committee, right? That's a good thing to have, viewpoint diversity on this committee. I would expect that would be a good thing.
Yeah.
And that's my concern.
I think it's also, it's a good thing not to have someone who is...
Not with the program. Goal, get with the program. Come on, yeah, pro-Israel.
No, I mean...
That's right.
That's sort of the, it's almost like on the, you're not going to hire the CEO of Pepsi to sit on the Coke's board of directors. Maybe they would be helped by a difference of opinion, a difference of viewpoint, to say no, Pepsi's really much better. You guys suck.
Well, wait a second, I think it's interesting the way you're looking at that because that would suggest then that the job of the Foreign Affairs Committee is at least in some part to be uncritically supportive of Israel, and I would reject that assumption.
No, but it's the majority has, to the extent Congress dabbles in foreign policy, right? The majority has the right to sort of set the priorities, set the goals, set the, what's the word I'm looking for? The tone, the tenor of
that
of
tone thing. And, yeah, tone is a dangerous the word, tenor, isn't
right?
it?
And,
yeah.
And this goes to, listen, the majority party thinks that our relationship with Israel is important to our strategic national interests, and I agree. And it's decidedly unhelpful to have someone like Ilhan Omar on that committee. If she wants to make whatever floor speeches she wants, she's welcome to do that. But she doesn't have a guaranteed spot on the committee.
I understand your arguments. It rings alarm bells for me. In the academic world, we have various qualifications for tenure and promotion. And often, in many cases, one of them is something called collegiality. And, that's, of course, just so incredibly vague, right? It's like, is she a good colleague? What exactly does that mean? Well, could that be a way of silencing or somehow punishing people who maybe we just find kind of offensive?
It's not something, though, that they're kicking her out saying, oh, she's just not a good colleague. He's been pretty specific about here's why, right?
Oh, yeah.
Because, and I think it's.
But yeah. You know, because she says things we don't like.
Yes.
To be clear, you're not arguing that this isn't viewpoint discrimination. You're saying it's fine.
I'm saying it's perfectly acceptable. Gotcha. Viewpoint discrimination.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha. So, you know,
here's the thing. If the Speaker of the House were to somehow say, at some point, say, Representative Ilhan Omar, I'm not going to allow you to speak on any bills related to Israel. I'm going to shut you up in the middle of a floor speech if you say anti-Israeli things. All that. Well, then, no, I think that would definitely be a problem.
Gotcha. Okay.
But just say because you don't get to sit on this committee when there's plenty of other people who could serve ably on it. I think that's legit.
I see your point, and I disagree, but I also think that it is an entirely reasonable point, and you are not either ignorant or evil for advancing it. So how about that?
Well, thanks.
Yeah, you know, I generally think you don't fall into either of those two categories. So that actually brings us to the close of today's show. But before we go, we want to thank one of our newest supporters on Patreon, Kevin. Kevin, thank you so much. And thanks to everyone who supports the show. It wouldn't be possible without your help. And if you're not already a supporter, we hope you'll consider becoming one. When you become a supporter, you get all sorts of good stuff. You get ad-free versions of everything we put out, as well as our supporter-exclusive midweek show. And you can join our very active and always, as far as I'm concerned, a lot of fun Politics Guys Discord group. I'm on there every day, and we have a great group of people and some fun conversations. And so to check it all out, go to patreon.com/politicsguys. If you want to support us on Venmo, we're at Politics Guys. There's also PayPal, and you'll find all of our support links in the show notes, as well as at politicsguys.com/support. And if you'd like to get the midweek show, but you're not in a position to financially support us right now, that's totally not a problem. Just send me an email, mike@politicsguys.com, and I will get you set up. And whether you're a supporter or not, it helps us if you can subscribe, rate and review us on whatever podcast app you use, and share episodes on social media. We do love hearing from listeners, and there are so many ways to get in touch with us. If you still like email, hey, that's great. I use it all the time. mail@politicsguys.com. There's that Discord channel I mentioned. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, and you will find links to that in the show notes. And finally, as always, a very special thanks to our executive producers, Bruce Johnson, Wilma Moreno, Andra Masker, Daniel Toe, Ryan Beasley, and Don Oglesby. We'll be back with a new episode for you next week. We hope to join us.